Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And I have a feeling after this week's edition of the program that no comparison moniker is definitely going to be in full effect, because we have what I think is going to be a powerful edition of BOA Audio for you folks. Tonight on the program, our guest is Leslie Wagner Wilson. She is the author of the book, Slavery of Faith, and it details her life growing up, getting involved with the People's Temple, eventually moving to Jonestown and escaping Jonestown, and the difficulties that she faced following that escape. A lifetime of difficulties, really, coping with what went down back in November of 1978, and it is just an absolutely breathtaking book. It is a remarkable, remarkable story. It's something that, having read it, just lived with me ever since I finished the book. It's that powerful and really resonating. So I wanted to talk to her, have her on the program. I had heard her on Brian Alvarez's After Dark radio show and was completely blown away at the time and knew that I want to get her on BOA Audio so we could really sink our teeth into this Jonestown story. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Leslie. Really, really looking forward to this one.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Thank you. I'm looking forward to it also.
Now, generally, you know, we start out the program with like a bio background, you know, because we have people who do stuff and their thing is, you know, not related to their bio background. But your bio background is your story. Your story is the story. So I don't want to hit you with the bio background, because then the show will be over and I won't get a chance to talk to you. So I guess let's talk a little bit first before we sort of start, you know, your bio here. You know, like I remarked to you before we started the program, it's like I feel bad that you've been through this and I'm going to be talking to you tonight about this and asking you questions and you know, some of them aren't going to be pleasant questions, because this was an unpleasant experience. So I mean, how do you deal with all that? And you know, like you said before the show started, just go wherever you want to go. And I really appreciate that. So, but you know, how do you get to a place like that?
You know, it's interesting, because when we first came back to the United States from Jonestown, Guyana, there was such, we were stigmatized, and you didn't talk about it because the way that people received it, as these crazy people who followed this man into the jungles and killed themselves. And so the climate has changed and the atmosphere has changed to where people really want to know what happened, and they're trying to get their heads around it. How could this happen? And so it's important. It's an important topic. So it's not hard to talk about now, because I see the good that it's doing. It's giving those that died, those 924 people, including 9 of my family members, a voice. And it's important. So it's I live it every day, and I'm okay with that now. I'm okay with that now. Okay. But thank you for that.
Oh, I mean it. It's a tough, like I laughed with you about it before the show started. You've been through enough. Why do you got to talk to a schlub like me about all this? But I'm really looking forward to sort of sharing this story with the listeners. Now, I guess we'll like I said, this is sort of a non-traditional episode in a sense. So like, let's do sort of the bio. Tell me a little bit about, you know, who Leslie Wagner was leading into, you know, before you even heard about the People's Temple. How did you even get mixed up in all this in the first place? And how was your life before these paths crossed, let's say?
I had an incredible childhood. My mother stayed at home. My father was a top salesman at his company in San Francisco. We were considered upper middle class. My dad was a member of the Marin County Country Club. We went to, you know, summer vacations every year, skiing, you know, horseback riding, camping. And then was able to go away to camp every summer for a week or two, you know, sleepaway camp. And I had a great childhood, you know, close to my grandparents and my parents, you know, close-knit, you know, friends. And so it was absolutely wonderful. My parents divorced when I was around 10. And my mother moved us to Santa Rosa, California, which is around about 2 hours outside of Ukiah or River Valley, where People's Temple was, you know, was stationed in California. And it was during the late 60s. And I had an older sister, Michelle, who passed, you know, in Jonestown. And she got involved in drugs, you know, mescaline, acid, and was running away from home and just giving my mother grief. And a friend of my mother's told my mom about this church called People's Temple Disciples of Christ, who had a great drug rehab program for youth. And so that's how we began. We went to a couple services up there and ended up moving, you know, relocating about a year later. So that was how we got to People's Temple.
Yeah. And then, like, relocating into just sort of, like, moving to the town where it was based, right?
Right. And actually, you know, not knowing at 13 that when you move, when you come to Redwood Valley, when you go into People's Temple, you're in People's Temple. There's no outside anything. So life definitely changed. I remember the first time I was, you know, first day of school, and I was talking to these kids, and this young girl comes up to me, and she asked me, you know, are you in the church? And I didn't understand what she was referring to.
Right.
And she goes, People's Temple. And I said, you know, I'm still thinking, what does she mean, in the church? And so I said, yes, I go to People's Temple. And she said, well, you can't talk to anybody that's not part of People's Temple. So that was my first realization that it was different than anything than we had ever been before. If I didn't know it before, I definitely knew it then.
Right, right. And what's interesting is, you know, like you recount in the book, as you were first getting into it, then you start going to these, let me see where it says here, Temple's youth group meetings. That's when they start putting all these thoughts into you guys' heads about socialism and, you know, impending doom and all kinds of stuff like that, correct?
Right, because Jim Jones moved from Indiana to People's Temple, Ukiah, because it's, you know, high, you know, it's Northern California, with the telling the members that he brought with him that there was an impending nuclear war. Of course, we were in that time still, to a certain
right.
degree. And so, and there was a cave that if anything, you know, we would be able to survive a nuclear war. And so we were faced with death, you know, as soon as we walked in the door. It was talk about, like you said, doom. And then the youth group, and, you know, then, of course, we were introduced to socialism, apostolic socialism, and that's what we studied. And then we used to have drills, you know, military drills, tuck and rolling in the mountains. Like, you know, we thought we were being trained to be revolutionaries to save the world, or in case the nuclear war happened, we would be able to survive.
Yeah.
In hindsight, it was insane.
Yeah,
but that's
yeah.
what we were taught.
Yeah, it's very, like, foreign to think, but like, when you're in it, I guess you're of that mindset. That's the remarkable part. Now, you talked about how the kid at school was, you know, she said you could only talk to people from the church. I guess talk about sort of like how the early parts of this sort of like paranoia comes in, because, you know, it gets worse and worse as you get deeper into this. But it's like you're already sort of they're playing mind games with you already, kind of, you know.
Right, and I think the difference, you know, the difference between being young and brought in is because you don't have any choice. You're with you're with a parent or a guardian. And so you look at your family members, my mom, and she's engaged, and she seems to be happy. And so you think, okay, well, this is a new life. I'm grateful to my mother because I grew up in such a environment that we could adjust, adaptable.
Yeah.
And I think that's what saved me in the long run, was being able to adapt to different situations. But in the beginning, it was, you know, it was okay because I was young. And then the more I learned about socialism and the more involved we became, I felt special. I felt that, you know, we're really doing something to change the world. You know, we're really going to make a difference. And I grew up in a family that my mother was very giving. You know, she started the care home. Even when my parents were divorced, people would come stay with us. It was like this, it was almost like, you know, similar to the church. And of course, I grew up in an interracial household. My father was Caucasian, so looking at Jim didn't look any different than looking at my dad. Color was never an issue in my house. I didn't recognize color until it was brought to me in People's Temple. But we were taught that anybody outside wasn't worthy, that they were just, you know, bourgeois, capitalist, and all they cared about what, you know, were themselves. And so the more that you were indoctrinated, the easier it became to really believe in what he was saying. And I remember, you know, going to different cities and traveling and passing out leaflets, going to San Francisco in the heart of the ghetto and knocking on doors. There was a project called the Pink Palace. They've torn it down now on the Fillmore, this high rise that, you know, we get on the elevators and they reach a urine. We knock on people's door, invite them to People's Temple, you know, being downtown on Market Street and asking for money for this orphanage that later on we found out never existed. And collecting hundreds of dollars,
yeah,
you know, begging. And but we were, I felt like it was important work because I believed in what he was telling me. We really did. And so it wasn't hard, you know, for us to be able to, you know, give up things that kids do, like proms, you know, and participate in sports, and because we're writing letters all night to try to get someone out of prison, or, you know, writing a congressman regarding something that's happening that shouldn't be, whatever. So we felt really empowered that we were really making a difference.
Yeah.
And so the paranoia was slow to come, but it definitely came.
Yeah, yeah. At what point did you meet Jim Jones, and what was that like initially?
Just him, you know, saying hello. And, you know, I wasn't close to him because really what happened was, there was a fear that was created because we had to call him father at some point. And he was on this pedestal and he was almost, you know, if you touched his robe, you felt like you were, you know, it was that type of, what he portrayed was this person that was just full of love and healing. But also he told us that he could read our minds. And so if we have a negative thought, you would force it out. So what you didn't do, what I didn't do, was try to get close to him. If he came, he spoke, I'd speak, but I didn't try to have a conversation or anything because, you know, it was a love and a fear. You know, you loved him, but you feared him.
Yeah.
You did. And so just a, you know, cordial hello, and my mother started getting involved, but I think probably the greatest time that I think then he told me that I was his little Angela Davis, I was beaming with joy because I thought, oh my gosh, I'm getting this compliment from father. And he's approving of me because like a father or a parent, you want approval.
Right.
And that's what we strive to do. Get his approval.
Very, it's unsettling. It's unsettling just thinking about being around this guy. Yeah. So I can kind of see how you're put off. You just don't want to even be around because you're afraid you're going to like make a misstep or something. Or if he can read your mind, you're going to think the wrong thing. And it's like, so you just try
exactly.
to like steer clear of him.
Stay clear.
Yeah.
That's what I did in the entire time, pretty much.
Now, I guess the next sort of like big moment in your life is you meet Joe Wilson and, and subsequently you have your son, Jakari. So I guess talk a little bit about that because, you know, those two are, you know, the two key sort of other players in this whole story.
Right. Joe was my best friend, actually. And my first boyfriend was his best friend, so he became my best friend. And he was rough around the edges. Everyone loved him. Most people liked him, then they feared him because he had a horrible temper. But we started off as friends and ended up in a relationship that was just, you know, my mother just had a fit. My grandparents were just through, you know, even though they weren't in the church, they met him. They were just like he's not for you, you know.
Yeah.
basically because he wasn't white. I think that was the biggest thing with my family. You know, so that whole color thing going on, and my dad just hated him, you know, when he met him. But I met Joe, we were best friends, and then we ended up being, you know, in a relationship, and then I got pregnant, you know, and I remember backing up, Joe, you know, one thing about being in people's temples that you were told to be honest, and I had moved in with Joe at about 17. Mm-hmm. My mother had threatened statutory rape and this and that, and because he was, you know, four years older than me. Mm. And, you know, he took a handful of pills at one point and tried to kill himself. And that brought us closer together. And then at one point he decided that he was going to be honest with me because I finally turned 18 and we could actually get married. So he told me he had these, you know, sleeping with these other women. And later, years later, I could really appreciate that honesty because he actually was giving me a choice. You know, yeah. I'm letting you know this because I want you to understand, because people are going to come to you and they're going to tell you. So I want to tell you first. And I didn't respect it then because I was too young to understand what that honesty really meant.
Right.
And so I tried to take some pills and, you know, take myself out, although I really wasn't trying because I left the bottle next to the bed, so hoping somebody would find
me.
You know. And so I moved out, and then I ended up pregnant, and I remember being called to the front of the church. And when anything was going on, there's any problems or, you know, they called a catharsis, and that's when Jim would call your name or somebody would call your name, and you had to go to the front of the church, the temple. And they would just, whatever it was, you would be confronted with, whether it's not you fell asleep during the service or you didn't go to work or you talked crazy to someone, whatever. It was just, you didn't know why. So I get called up to the floor, and then he calls Joe, and I'm thinking, why am I being called up? Because nobody knew, only one person knew I was pregnant. And Jim called, you know, Joe comes up and he says, you know, we know you're pregnant. And he asked Joe, are you going to marry her? And he says, no.
Yeah.
So I'm in front of this temple with all these people. And I'm being humiliated. He's telling me, no, he doesn't want to marry him. And I just haul off and hit him in the mouth. And he starts bleeding. And they hold him, you know, and I run down the aisle. I'm just running because I'm like, okay, because he had a temper. He never put his hands on me, but still.
Right, right.
And so later on, we ended up, you know, getting together and having Jakari. And it was a turning point for me in many ways. I was 18, and although I had experience before People's Temple, there were still things that I didn't realize until I had my child that I was just not ready to be a mom, although I loved him.
Mm.
I was too young.
Yeah.
And so eventually I ended up having surgery in San Francisco and coming back up to Ukiah. And then eventually my sister was in San Francisco and I couldn't find work, you know. I got laid off, and Joe was not working, and we ended up living on this, you know, commune, which, you know, this little room with two bunk beds, which was just not appealing to me because we had our own place for, you know, a long time.
Right.
And ended up moving down to San Francisco with my sister, and then it was pretty much over by then. I just realized that there is more to life than People's Temple. And by that time, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh yeah, well that's what I was just gonna sort of bring you to that point, and also ask, like, you know, when this all goes down with you and Joe in front of everybody, I'm sure, like, I guess it does kind of lead to this, you know, where you're thinking to yourself, I've had enough of this place and these people and these rules and everything else, you know, it's like you're young, you're 18, could you have even, if you wanted to, could you have just bailed on this at that point, or was it like already so entrenched in your life that they would have sort of drag you back, if you will?
It would have been difficult to leave, although I believe I could have, because my father, there were some families in People's Temple that had connections, and so they weren't they were handled a different way. And our family was one of those families. My dad was friends with the district attorney of San Francisco, and so there was things that we were allowed to do, like see our grandparents and such, that other families weren't. So I believe had I went to my dad and told, I know that if I went to my father, that I would have had a safe haven.
Yeah.
But, you know, in hindsight, I don't think I was confused. I didn't know what I wanted at that point. I knew that me witnessing, you know, the beatings, because it, you know, they started in River Valley, where people were beat with a paddle. Some beat so badly they couldn't sit down. It was just horrific. To the all-night services, and then going to San Francisco, and then that increasing, you know, then it turned into boxing matches. And so I was confused because I grew up in this.
Right.
And although, and I believed in what we were doing to a certain degree, but I started seeing something different. And even at that age, it just didn't make sense to me. I realized that People's Temple was being really ran off of the fear of people. And so, yeah, I think if I had went to my dad, I definitely, he would have taken me in. I wasn't ready. And
yeah.
I wasn't ready for that fight. I just wasn't.
Oh, exactly. I'm sure you, a decision like that probably would have just wreaked complete havoc on your life and everything. So it's like, it's one of those, do you decide to do it or not kind of things. But, you know, if we're kind of following this timeline of your life, and, you know, like you said, you know, you get down to San Francisco, a lot of it, you're sort of like you say in the book, you know, you have like 1 foot in the church and 1 foot out.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind
mm-hmm.
of like, you're enjoying the dance clubs. You're sort of just living mm-hmm. your life and everything. And, we're close to you going to Jonestown relatively. What's sort of the mood in the church? How is this? What is the talk of this Jonestown? You know, has it already sort of begun and got up and running yet? Or is it sort of like an idea, a faraway idea? Or was it something you were completely kept in the dark about until one day they were like, yeah, we got a place in Guyana, so, you know, get ready to move there eventually. Like, how did this all come up, Jonestown, as far as the church is concerned?
Well, basically, Jim said they had bought, you know, agricultural land. They had bought, you know, agriculture, you know, in the jungle in Jonestown, Guyana.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us had never, you know, known, we never heard of Guyana. It was called French Suriname, I believe, at one time when the British had it. And they were building this community for people to go and live. And it was, you know, we're going to plant our own food, and we're going to live in a place where, you know, there was no racism and there was no isms. Well, the church wasn't supposed to be any isms anyway, but, you know, there was just going to be this paradise that we could live together and work together and build this community. And it was going to, you know, be an example to the world. So they actually had started, they had broken ground, and there were crews that were over there building it. But I didn't, so we heard of it, you know, we saw pictures, there was some film, and it was primitive.
Yeah.
You know, it was primitive. There was no, you know, concrete streets or cars or, was just this, you know, community that had these cabins.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's not for me, I'm a city girl, you know.
Mm.
And so that's the picture. Those are the films, you know, the film that he shows. People knew about it. I don't think we realized that.
They were all going to
end
up there.
That's not how it was supposed to go down at all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Once everybody moves to a whole other country and everything, then you're getting even deeper, you know. You're just like the harrowing journey just to Jonestown from America is like crazy, as you recounted in the book, because you completely talk about being taken away from your support system or anything. You're completely isolated from everybody at that point. Once you get down to Jonestown, it's terrifying, really, in a lot of ways. But I guess recount for the audience, you know, how the series of events that took you to Jonestown. Because, like, I kind of alluded to them here, that Joe goes down there with Jakari. Actually, let me just circle back a little bit just so I can kind of wrap my head around this. Because what's the sort of timeline here as far as, like, how long have you been in the People's Temple before you went down to Jonestown?
Well, that was around 5 years by then. But remember, so I'm 19.
Mm-hmm.
And I take a job at the Hyatt Regency downtown San Francisco, and I work from 3 to 11. So my way of back and out of the church was I wasn't ready to make the total move because my son, and I still had hopes. You know, this is what I was raised in. I still had some, you know, I still had hopes, and I was brainwashed. And so, but as time, you know, the beatings increased. There was this thing called the Green Monster. They shot kids in this room, and it was just getting more and more bizarre to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's talk of rumors about someone who left who was killed, you know, on the railroad track. And it was just too much. It was so much going on. And Jim was becoming more and more paranoid. And so my one foot in was me going to a service. I would never go on a Wednesday night because that's when they can call you up.
Right, right.
So I might show up on a Sunday, you know, might show up for a Sunday service.
Okay, so but, like you're kind of like a People's Temple member, almost in name only at this point.
Right. I'm still, you know, I still had to have the relationship, and then Jakari was staying with the family that we had lived with in Redwood Valley. Joe and I had separated, so Joe was in Ukiah, and then finally we moved down and tried to live communally, you know, in a commune, which to me was just. You know, they wanted me to give up my check, and I remember finding this article, this document on the website that said Leslie Wagner Wilson's not turning in her checks, you know, because I didn't want to turn in my paycheck.
Yeah.
So I got away with a lot, but by that time, Joe and I were completely separated, and Jim was right before the New West article came out that there was a group of what they called defectors that left People's Temple and were talking to the press and sharing, you know, what was really happening, you know, behind closed doors. Because remember, during that time, Jim was the head of the Housing Commission. He was in a powerful position.
Right, right.
And
right.
He had Willie Brown. He had Moscone. He had the Who. He was a creme de la creme of San Francisco at the time, because what People's Temple could do was bring a vote.
Mm.
There was a telephone tree. If there was something that someone needed, a politician, they needed someone to show up or protest or vote, it was a phone call, and you might have 200 or 300 people there.
Right, right.
So his power in San Francisco was because of the membership.
Mm. Yeah, people need to sort of like, you know, take a moment, folks, and think about that, because it's like, now all this is, like you said at the very beginning of the conversation, now all this is sort of like written off, that these people were all crazy and followed this guy down there and everything. But at the time, you know, I don't know if it was in your book or if it was in further research I was doing on this whole story, but I saw somewhere that, like, Harvey Milk, the legendary Harvey Milk, wrote a letter decrying the defectors and saying they were, you know, that they were just trying to smear the People's Temple. So, I mean, that's how big time they were in the San Francisco area. They were, you know,
right.
They were respectable. That's kind of, you know, that's
right.
Kind of how it was. So, you know, it's pretty, it's a pretty remarkable thing to wrap your mind around, you know.
So that was the thing, was he had so much power at that point. And what I remember serving dignitaries that came, you know, us being taught how to serve from the left to the right, how to do this, whatever. And, you know, because there was a banquet. And but they didn't know what was going on behind closed doors, because those meetings, when we had those meetings, people, when you just couldn't walk into People's Temple and walk upstairs to any service. You had to be screened and almost interviewed before you would even get in the door. And so he made sure that people that were there that Wednesday night were actually People's Temple members. There was no guest on Wednesday nights.
Yeah.
Because that's when all the stuff was really happening.
I guess take me into one of those Wednesday nights and describe it a little bit more, because I'm trying to, like, I don't know, wrap my mind around the fear of that situation and how tense it must have been and what was going down. So, like, what would it be like?
It would be you walk into a meeting, you have a seat, and you sit, I'm sitting as far back as possible. You will never find a picture of me in People's Temple, rarely. You see me anywhere.
How many people are at these at the meeting?
A couple hundred.
Wow, okay.
A couple hundred. And someone gets called to the carpet. Let's say someone fell asleep during a meeting. And they've had two or three warnings. So Jim says, you know, calls out that person's name. And then says, okay, you want to stay awake. You know, you're not staying awake. You're being a bad socialist. You're not, you know, you're being selfish. Because that was a key word, selfish and self-centered. And, and we're going to match you up with someone to box. And I would tell you that the opponent, this person was always the weaker person. And they knew better not to, because my husband was one of the boxers.
Yeah.
And my husband, Joe could fight. I mean, he was a fighter. And they would beat that person until they were bloodied. And the smart ones would just lay down, one punch and lay down and take it.
Yeah.
And not get back up and try to fight. But sometimes Jim would say, get back up, you know, come on. It got to be very sadistic. And so the fear in the room was that you just hoped that your name wasn't called. You didn't fall asleep. You didn't make a sound. Even to go to the bathroom, you're like, you know, you had to pick your moment of when to get up because you just didn't want to be noticed. You just didn't want to be noticed. Because at that point, it was rhyme or reason. And that's how sadistic it became. It could be someone that, you know, talked a certain way to someone that, you know, had a question, even questioned Jim. Like, why do we have meetings that are till 2 o'clock in the morning? And it got to the point where that's when the paranoia started, really began, because was locked in because you didn't know who you could trust. And then you had people that were telling on you.
Yeah.
You might have someone befriend you, and the next thing you know, you're in front of the church, in front of the temple, and then they're sharing something that you share with them that you didn't want to share with anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was just an atmosphere of paranoia and fear. But the question that I have to this day is, you know, as a child, you know, we're raised up so it's different. But even for my mother, what was lacking in my mom that she continued to do this? Because I know the exact moment when I knew my mother was so locked in, because Jim used to say that he could raise the dead, drop you dead and raise you up. And I remember being in the San Francisco temple. And Jim yells out, Inez Wagner, give up the ghost. And she drops to the floor. And I'm thinking, what the heck is going on? You know, to myself, what is going on? I didn't run to my mother because I knew she wasn't dead.
Weird.
And so, but for her to do that, I realized that my mom, you know, because my mother had by that time moved to San Francisco, back to San Francisco, and was living in the commune. My mother was totally, totally involved in this thing.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, like you said, she was locked in. Yikes.
She was gone. Yeah.
Now, I guess it probably runs the gamut, but what's sort of like the average age of all these people, you know, who were part of the People's Temple? Because it sounds, because you know, from your perspective, you're dealing with all the kids and stuff, or the teenagers, and sort of the young generation. But I'm wondering, you know, is it really across the? I know you say there were like seniors at Jonestown. So give me sort of an idea of you know what the demographics were like here amongst all these folks in the People's Temple.
A lot of seniors, a lot of elderly Black folks, and children. And you know, we have kids that were in the foster system that were living with families. So you had the a lot of children because you know 306 children died in Jonestown.
Mm-hmm.
You had a lot of seniors because they had residential care homes for seniors. They had senior homes. So you had seniors. And then you had the age between, let's say, 22 to, you know, 50 or 60.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't balanced. It wasn't I would say it was probably more seniors than anything to a certain degree.
Interesting.
And, of course, the elderly, because one thing People's Temple brought was, you know, health care, free legal service because we had attorneys, we had a doctor, we had nurses, and, you know, we fed people. People could come to the church and eat. And on Wednesday nights, there were you know, concession stands where people could fry chicken and sell their goods and clothes and jewelry. And after church or during a break, they can come down and eat. And so people were making money, but I guarantee you they were putting it right back in People's Temple.
Right
back in People's Temple. Well, but the thing about it is, it's...
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say... No, well, you go ahead, Leslie.
I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it.
How it was so interracial. Well, it wasn't... The majority of people, they were Black. You know, so it wasn't... Interracial to me is like, you know, equal. you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a whole mixture, but it wasn't. It was, you know, Caucasians, mainly, that were in leadership, and then Black folks. And a lot of them, you know, we had some professionals, but... The majority of people were poor. They were disenfranchised. You know, we had drug dealers and hookers and pimps and, you know, we had the gamut of everyone. It was like a little city to a certain degree.
Very interesting, yeah. The other sort of idea that people always have, and I think it's borne out here in the Jonestown story, is, and you said it, you sort of alluded to it. That's what I was trying to jump in there for a moment, moments mm-hmm. ago to ask about this. It's like the folks who were in the People's Temple, they were like pouring their money into the People's Temple as well, right? I think you mentioned at one point in the book, when you arrive in Jonestown, or on the journey to Jonestown, you come across a young mm-hmm. couple or a middle-aged couple that had just given mm-hmm. like over $100,000 to the People's Temple, and you said they kind of looked like they were beginning to second guess that decision. So
right.
We're talking serious, right. serious money is going into this. So was that sort of like going on in a big way, that people were giving just their whole, you know, everything to the church?
Yes, because my mother, you know, sold her house, and she sold her house, and we ended up renting. You know, and I never understood that. But, of course, those things, you don't really talk about. Parents back then didn't talk their business to you, but I knew that.
Right.
And so there were a lot of people that, because that's what, you know, Jim, he wanted you to tithe. But the whole thing about People's Temple, it wasn't a church. It was designated, it fell under Disciples of Christ because it gave him the tax break and gave him the validity.
Hmm.
You know, legitimizing the fact that it was a church. It was not a church because we never had Bible study. There was no Bible study. You know, there was no, you know, we had choir rehearsal, but there was no Bible study. There was no, it was not, you know, I've gone to regular churches. My grandparents were, you know, deacon and deacon of a Baptist church. So I know what a real church looks like.
Right.
But people were still tithing and giving their money. And then, you know, it was like 25%. And then he opened up the communes, and once people started buying into this communal situation, and which was really preparing them for Guyana, although I don't think they knew it, that they were giving all their money to the church, working outside, you know, out in the world, bringing home their money. And I remember this, we had a needs committee, and you would go to the needs committee and say, well, I need socks, I need deodorant, I need toothpaste. I need shampoo, and they would give you these items. I need bus fare, and they give you the bus fare, but then you had to come back. Anything that you needed outside that they didn't have, you had to bring the receipts back the next week to balance it out.
Oh, my God. So they've got you
right?
also, like, totally dependent on them.
Absolutely. Because people that are giving their entire – I mean, I'm literally giving up their whole paycheck. And maybe living off of $15 a week, maybe.
Jesus.
There was one guy that said, I lived off a dollar a week, and I saved that for a Coke.
Oh, my
right?
God. It's unbelievable what people will do, you know, that what they'll put up with. You know, it's really, that's the remarkable thing. It's like, you know, they're not being forced to do it somehow. Well, they are in a way, but they aren't. It's like really weird. It's really, really strange. Okay, so we've talked about the demographics. We've talked about sort of the numbers here. We sort of took a little break here from your story. So let's get back to, you're on your way to Jonestown, how it all goes down, how you end up traveling to Guyana. So I guess let's pick it up with that point in your story. So take it away, Leslie.
Well, I had to correct you because my son went with Jim when he made his exodus from the state.
Oh, okay. Now that I think about it, yeah, because I remember you said Joe had only been there a day when you got there, so that makes sense.
Right. And so that was the way that what the strategy of People's Temple was to separate the children, to separate the families, the nuclear family.
Yeah.
And so my child wasn't my child. My child was someone else's child. And my mother wasn't my mother. My mom was, you know, that's how he broke up the family unit, which, once you do that, then everything can happen that shouldn't happen because the unity is gone and that family unit is gone. So the church is your – People's Temple is your family. And so what Jim would do is start – you know, he might send someone, which is exactly what happened with us, is that Joe came to me because, again, they're noticing that I'm not there, you know, and – before I started being a bad girl, you know, I was a good girl. I was on the testimonial committee. I was dedicated. And then there's this major shift that goes on.
Mm.
And they're looking at so Jim decides once that New West article came out exposing, the article hadn't come out yet, but it was about to come out in this New West magazine. So instead of Jim facing it, because we don't understand those of us that are, I call us peons, who didn't understand the dynamics of what that meant for him, because we didn't see behind the scenes of all the stuff that was happening, you know, the threats to people, the break-ins, and just, you know, horrific stuff that normal churches don't do.
Yeah.
And right, you know, that's not love. And so basically, Jim decided, you know, that he wanted to take Jakari with him. And because, again, I'm one foot in, one foot out. And part of me said, well, Jakari is going to be better without me, because at this point I'm thinking I'm just the worst socialist ever. You know, I'm a capitalist now. I'm living outside of the world, in the world, you know, and he would be better off without me. In my head, that's what I'm thinking. And so that's how brainwashed I was to let my 1.5-year-old child travel, you know, 2,500, I don't know how many miles to Guyana.
Yeah.
But he wasn't alone. He was with a family friend who was like my other sister. And I trusted her with him. But still, I allowed him to go. And so when Jakari left, I was in an apartment they put me in because Joe's parents were coming out. And we were separated. They wanted to pretend like we were still together because Joe's mother was, you know, Joe's mother had a PhD. She's a very highly educated woman, you know, was a bishop of a church. And
right.
So this is what they did. You know, you acted. So we put me in this apartment, and they left. Joe left, and I was still in this apartment. And I'm like, great, they forgot about me. So, she, you know, I'm living my life. I'm still, you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to church once in a blue moon. And so I'm there one day, and I get this call. And they said, are you ready to go to Jonestown? And I, first of all, I couldn't believe they asked me because, you know, they normally don't ask. And this voice came into my head and said, if you don't go now, you'll never see your son again. Well, I didn't have a clue what that meant, but it scared me because I thought, never see my son again. You know, I'm thinking I don't want to go to Jonestown. I had no intention on going to Jonestown that 2 months later. So I said yes, and that's how I got to Jonestown. And that's how I got there.
It's interesting, Leslie. You have an interesting sort of like perspective on all this. You sort of brought it up earlier where it's like you never really willingly did a lot of this stuff. You didn't join the church, you know, you didn't kind of, you weren't just out there looking for an avenue to express your faith or whatever and joined up with the People's Temple. Like, you were sort of shoehorned in through your family as a kid, and you had no real inkling of what you were getting yourself into. And then, you know, later on, you're not like all gung-ho about going to Guyana and building this utopia. You're strong-armed essentially into it by fate and by the Jim and the circumstances. So it's really, I can just only imagine just how tough it must have been.
It was tough, but what I thought, you know, growing up in an adaptable family and being adaptable, I thought, okay, well, this is a chance to redeem myself, to be a better, you know, I hoped maybe Joe and I would get back together to be with my son and be a better mother and a better socialist. So I was willing, because one thing about me, once I convince myself of something, I can do it. It's just I have to make a decision.
Right.
So the decision was that voice in my head. And then from there, I was open. I didn't have any kind of expectation. I didn't know what to expect, but I made myself feel that, you know, I could, whatever happened, I could deal with. But I had to go because I didn't know what that meant. I couldn't risk it. I couldn't risk it.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know really if we need to get into the whole trip to Jonestown, just that it's really like elaborate and it's not, this isn't, you know, you didn't just fly in. It's not like you're going to Cleveland. This is like, this is a real multifaceted journey, let's say. So we'll sort of clue folks in on that. Tell them a little bit about what it takes to get from America to Jonestown.
Well, we took one of the Greyhound buses from San Francisco to Miami, got to Miami, the first group left. We left the next day. We get to, you know, the airport in Miami, and we ended up going to Puerto Rico and then Trinidad, Tobago. The interesting thing is when we got to Trinidad, we went to the ticket counter. We had an escort, and the gentleman said, you know, why are all these Americans going to this with the one-way ticket going to Guyana? He was just dumbfounded. And he said, just a moment. And so he went and got somebody else, and they said, we couldn't go. You know, we need to, you know, look into some things. So they ended up putting us in a hotel because, you know, Guyana was socialist at that time. And so by the time we left, there was, you know, a lot of people had already traveled through that route.
Yeah.
And so got there and stepped off the plane, and I was amazed. It was really almost like, you know, it looked war-torn. You know, buildings were not, it was not like San Francisco, let me put it like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I definitely felt like I was in a third world country.
Yeah.
But I was excited still because, again, I'm going to get ready to see my child, you know. And
yeah, I mean, I can see how it's kind of like an adventure in a way that you don't, you know, you had no idea how this was going to turn out. So it's not like you know what I mean? So I guess you put on the brave face and you sort of face the adventure in a way, right?
Exactly. And that's exactly what it was. It was a new adventure, and that's how I looked at it.
Yeah.
I had no, again, expectations. I didn't know what to expect. And but to get to Jonestown, from Georgetown, the capital, you either catch a boat, which takes 24 hours, or you fly in on, you know, like a small plane.
Hmm.
We were put on the boat, and that's how we traveled for 24 hours. And it was interesting because there was other people there. But I remember being at Lamaha Gardens when I got there. My best friend was there. And I asked her how Jonestown was, and she says, you have to see it to believe it. That's all she would say. You have to see it to believe it. And I thought, okay, well, what's it like? You have to see it. I can't describe it, you know, because I don't think they would share with anybody what it was like, because nobody, you know, if they said there was outhouses, half the people probably would have begged for there or went to the American embassy saying, I'm not going, because we didn't realize how primitive it was until you got there.
Yeah, yeah.
And so once I arrived and it was dark, I was good until, you know, they put us on this big tractor trailer and it's rough ride. And we get to this gate and it says People's Temple Agricultural Project. And I look and there's a guard check and there's, you know, people that I know from the States that had went that had guns. And I thought, why do they have guns? Because I thought this was a safe place.
Yeah.
And so that was my first, you know, my first thought was, why are there guns? Not realizing that it wasn't to keep people out, it was to keep people in.
Mm.
And then got into the compound and heard these voices and screams and yells, people happy, and was reunited with my child. And I was good.
Yeah.
I felt good. Yeah, you know, and it looked like a camp. I mean, I'm glad I went to sleepaway camp, and I'm glad we camped as kids because it was, you know, it gave me, for those people that had never seen a tent, or they had a difficult time, but again, I was adaptable. So that was my first introduction to Jonestown.
Okay. Now, when was this both in, you know, like what year and month or whatever was this, and how far into your days in the People's Temple was this?
Well, this was August of 77. And so by then I'd been in there about 6 years.
Okay. All right.
Because I spent 16 months in Jonestown.
All right. That was, yeah, okay, good. You saved me from having to do the math, so thank you. And how many, when you got there, were you sort of like, I presume there were people there originally who kind of like, who were the first wave. Were you kind of like the second wave? Like, how many people were there when you arrived? And because I know, obviously, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So, but I have a feeling that you kind of may have been sort of in the early days. I'm not sure, though. So that's what I'm asking.
Absolutely. Yes, because Jim arrived 2 months before we did. So Jim came in June. We came in August.
Okay.
So he had just, there were people there. I would say maybe, I'm not really good with numbers, maybe 100 or so then, possibly, when I first got there.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and,
like about 100, you said?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to circle back to something you said earlier, because it will come in sort of, I think, as the conversation develops about the time at Jonestown, and that is, you said it was like mostly black people, but the leadership was white. I guess there's sort of a two-part question. First is just sort of like, why do you think that dynamic even came about? Because that's a strange sort of dynamic. Like, why all these people were following this white guy who claimed he was God, while these African American people were following this white guy who sort of like claimed he was God. And also, you know, you talked about the leadership. I guess who obviously Jim Jones is the figurehead guy here. He's the one that's forever associated with. I mean, it's Jonestown, for God's sakes.
That's right.
Who are these other like leaders and sort of players underneath him that, in a way, sort of have. Well, who knows what was going on in their minds? You know, maybe they escaped being labeled tyrants from history because they were the underlings of this guy. But maybe they actually were awful people, or maybe they were super brainwashed because they were like lieutenants and stuff. But who were these other people that were sort of, you know, second in command kind of people that you kind of shouldn't cross? Also, you know what I mean? So there's the two part question. What do you make of the demographic difference here with the leadership, and also what's going on with that leadership?
Well, Jim touted that he was Native American. You know, so he didn't say he was ever white. Mm. He always said he was Native American. And then I heard that basically what he said was, you know, he went after black folks because black people are loyal, you know, which is evident in major churches. That's evident with what goes on now. People are still in these mega churches, et cetera. That's a whole different subject.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically I think that, you know, he touted, you know, they adopted a black child. They adopted a Korean child. They adopted children from different races, the rainbow family. That's what he presented, but that was not a leadership. So you had some of the old crew from in the beginning days in Indiana, Jack Beam, that were there. Archie Imes was, the Imes family was a loyal family that was black that came from Indiana. You had the Cobb family that was black that came from Indiana. But leadership was basically white, and that's only because that's how he set it up.
Yeah.
And then in San Francisco, what they had was this thing called the Planning Commission. And there was some really sick stuff that was going on there. I think if most people had known that, they would have left a long time ago. But it was a group of probably 100 people, and they had these meetings. And they'd be up all night, and they were plotting and planning. There was a lot of sick, sadistic, sexual stuff that was going on in those meetings. But again, the majority of people didn't have privy to that.
At the risk of, I gotta ask. I mean, so what are you saying? Like orgies and still like swinger parties, that kind of thing. I don't want to get too deep into it, but you know, it's too titillating for me not to ask.
Well, there was an instance where someone had to use the bathroom in front of somebody. You know, Jim said, "You're gonna use the bathroom." Got a bucket, and they had to go to the bathroom in front of everybody.
Oh, weird.
There was an instance where someone had to strip down. Naked.
Okay. So it's sort of like, yeah, it's like dehumanizing sexual stuff.
Exactly. And
okay.
I can only tell you to read this book, and I don't tout a lot of books that were written by people simple, but I will tell you that 6 Years with God by the Myrtles.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of the most profound. It's once you read that, you'll have understanding really, because they were in the Planning Commission.
Okay.
And they were actually killed in San Francisco, you know, years ago, but they defected and they wrote this book, and it's really, it's very, I was blown away.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, you know, and the readers too, it's really interesting, but I mean, listeners, but basically, so what Jim started doing was, you know, because even in River Valley, he was talking about having sex with men and women. And this is why I don't understand why my mother didn't grab her hands and run like crazy, because that was not what we grew up with, right?
Yeah.
And we're talking 70s.
Right.
But he slept with people so he could save them from leaving, because you know leaving would be detrimental to them, you know. And so basically there was women that were mainly, the leadership was really women, and in People's Temple, there were three women: Carolyn Layton, Annie Moore, and their sisters. Carolyn Layton also had a baby by Jim. Annie Moore and Maria Cassar were really the women that were running the show in People's Temple. And those were his mistresses, and those are the ones that were feeding him drugs and everything else. And so people that were in the Planning Commission in California, when they got to Jonestown, there was no need for that, because there was no system.
Right.
there was no need for them to spy on people. So everything that they did, the needs committee, all those people that had a position, their positions ended because Jonestown was now just ran by Jim Jones and his women, his mistresses.
Interesting. Okay.
So, yeah, and so when you looked at the dynamics of race, you know, the majority of people were black and of color, and the leadership was white. Those that had access to the bank accounts that we didn't know existed until after the people, Jonestown, were white women.
Hmm.
Nobody black had access to the millions of dollars that was found after Jonestown. But that was Jim's, and so that's why when people say, well, how do you follow? Because he says he's Native American, he's got dark hair. He could be Native American.
Right, right. I see that point, yeah.
You know, he could be, you know, and you believe him, because why would somebody say there's something that they're not? I mean, most people are just honest and authentic and true. So why would you think he would, you know, lie about that? And so basically the dynamics and the demographics of Jonestown were, the majority were black. And I think the saddest thing for me was looking at women that were my grandmother's age, you know,
yeah,
elderly women that had to use an outhouse. Because, you know, and I'll talk about how the crowding affected those types of things. But that was that's things that I saw later. Like, why are these women? You know, it was almost like a slave camp. It really was to me.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying. And, you know, like we talked about the money aspect of it, too. It's like not only are these older ladies having to use outhouses and stuff, but like all their Social Security and everything is getting poured into Jonestown. It's crazy. Well, why did he hoard all this money? Like, I can't, because, you know, when it all went down and everything, like you said, there was millions of dollars left over. It's like, was he that paranoid too that he he doesn't seem to make any sense, because you guys were really suffering within Jones.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, why, it doesn't make it's paradoxical. It's like, what's going on with this? Why is this happening? Do you have any, you know, what's your speculation on why it was like that?
And that's exactly what it is. It's a speculation, because I think possibly in the beginning, I know Jim was using drugs in California later, you know, now we find out. So he was already sick then. He was already set for the things that were happening behind closed doors in the planning commission. But once he got to Jonestown, there may have been a plan to do something else. You know, there was a talk. We had a Russian person come in, and he was talking about us going to Russia, and we were taught Russian, like Das Vidanya.
Yeah.
You know, we were taught Russian, and you know, if you get a Russian question, if you didn't answer it, you couldn't eat, whatever. But I mean, so I don't know if he was really planning for us to relocate. I think possibly there's a thin chance in the beginning when things started going left for him, that there was possibly the money there to use for an escape.
Mm.
However, the worse he got, you know, and of course we didn't see all this. We might hear some slurring of words, but who would think he was on drugs? I mean, I never even thought about it.
Yeah, yeah.
It never even crossed my mind. And so possibly, and then I think it got to the point to where he was so out of it and he couldn't leave Jonestown. But of course we didn't know that. We knew that there were custody battles. We didn't know there was IRS and, you know, State Department and, you know, you're taking Social Security checks. We got foster kids over here. We didn't know the extent of the investigations that were happening. And Jim was actually a prisoner in Jonestown.
Interesting. So he was as stuck there as you guys were, but he was stuck because he couldn't leave because he would face all kinds of possible criminal charges and stuff.
Right. He couldn't leave. He could not go into Georgetown, the capital.
Oh wow, he couldn't even leave. Wow. See, I thought maybe he was just sort of stuck outside the United States, but he was just kind of in complete lockdown. That's remarkable. Now Joe, to return to Joe for a minute, we'll get into, we got a lot to talk about here with Jonestown, but with Joe, he was part of he was like head of the security for Jonestown. And I presume the answer is like no, because of the rampant paranoia, but I presume he was sort of close enough to the power base of Jonestown that he had an inkling that things were going wrong, but he never sort of like betrayed that those feelings to you, right?
Oh, no. So Joe was part of security. He became, when right before the congressman left, when the boys, the basketball team, which was Jim's sons, were sent to Georgetown to play, then his role increased because there wasn't as much security there. But, no, he would not ever share with me. We had one conversation where we talked about, I asked him, you know, what would happen if Jim died? And he said there would be bloodshed. And I said, well, what would we do? He said we would go to New Jersey to his parents' house with Jakari.
Yeah.
And that's as far as the conversation, you know, got. And, again, I was not trying to rock any boats.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, at any time to, you know, because we'll get into the, you know, I was already had the mark on my forehead after a while from a couple of things I did. Yeah.
Okay, so you're in Jonestown. They're putting you to hard labor work, you know, on cutting bananas and sort of in the banana fields, and it just sounds kind of brutal, honestly. It's you kind of mentioned the outhouses and stuff. I guess talk about the conditions there, because they are pretty hairy stuff. It's pretty like, whoa, what have I gotten myself into once you kind of dig further into it. So I guess like talk about what it was like living there initially and the basics of that kind of thing.
Well, when I first got there, you know, Joe and I weren't together, and Jakari was staying with the children because the children were in one big room like a nursery. And then finally we got back together, and we were allowed to actually keep him, which I still don't understand how that happened, because your parents didn't keep their children. And so basically we got a cabin of boys. You know, we had boys, and Joe was really good with kids. He loved children.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had this cabin with boys, and you know, I go to work in the field, and he did security. And then I took a class on medical, medical assistant, like taking blood pressures and all that. And then I thought, well, I want to be a doctor. And I, you know, pleaded my case. I was able to go and work with Larry Schack, our doctor. And so I spent about 3 days, about 4 days in the doctor's office, and then 2 days, you know, in the fields, because you work Monday through Saturday.
Right.
From, you know, in the fields, you work from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And so I really loved medicine, and I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be an OBG. I wanted to deliver babies. I wanted to be OBGYN.
Yeah.
And Larry taught me a lot. You know, I spent a lot of time in the office and studying and looking at cells and doing pap smears at one time. And I was supposed to be myself and another young woman named Corliss, who wanted to be an ophthalmologist. We were told that we were going to be sent to Cuba to become doctors. And so I felt good because I was really doing something that I loved. And even when I went out in the fields, I thought, okay, well, it's keeping me centered.
Mm.
You know, it's keeping me centered. And I'm still doing my part. So at first I was good. Things were good. We were getting a quarter chicken, rice and gravy, and peanut butter fudge, which I love today, on Sundays, you know, and you know, we sit around, we talk, and of course Jim would be on the microphone, or, you know, on Sundays we would listen to BBC, because, you know, we heard nothing except for what was coming into us. We didn't know what was happening outside of Jonestown, except
right.
What we were being fed. And so I was okay. You know, the outhouse thing was difficult. For me, it was the showers, because the showers reminded me of the showers they showed at Auschwitz, the big showers with rows of shower heads.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what it reminded me of, like the showers in the concentration camps. And you had to, so there's no privacy. You had 2 minutes to take a shower, and somebody would come up to you and say, you've been in here 2 minutes, it's time to get out. You know.
Oh, God.
And, of course, the water was cold. And that's why I felt for the seniors, because there was no modesty. You know, you couldn't be modest. It was just no way. And then as time increased, you know, more people came. And so the cabins were cabins that had bunk beds. And then some people would sleep in the loft, you know, on top, which was nice because you had a lot of space, even though it was kind of close. Like an attic, you know. And you had couples' cottages and you had singles' cottages. So the couples, if you were a couple, then you would sleep. There might be 6 couples in that cabin with you.
Hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Right, right.
So it's not, yeah, it's not like a, it's not like a bungalow for just you and your sweetheart. Yeah.
Oh no, no, you share that cabin with other married couples, and so, and then you had the singles cabin. You know, the men and the women.
Was space an issue as more people? I know, like, food supply was an issue, but was, like, space for sleeping arrangements and all that an issue as more people came?
Yes, because they couldn't keep up. They couldn't build fast enough.
Yeah.
You know, so some people were sleeping on the floors, and some people might have three people in the loft versus, you know, where it was built for one or two.
And what was Jim living like down there? You know, did he have kind of, like, did he have, you know, was he kept away? What was that? What was his living arrangements?
He was down. He wasn't near everybody else. He was down behind the doctor's office. So no one. I never went to Jim's house. I never stepped in. No one stepped inside Jim's house unless you were invited. And there was very few people that were invited. But, you know, later on, I heard there was a refrigerator. You know, he had steaks and Dr. Peppers and candy. You know, they ate well.
Right.
They ate well. We didn't.
Yeah. They kept you guys. Yeah. They kept you guys in the dark about all that.
Right, because, you know, how would father be? You know, he's supposed to be a socialist leader. He's supposed to do with that, too. We're all supposed to be eating the same.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Just even beyond the, like, the political end of it, it's, like, just the human nature of it, I think there would be, like, a revolution, an uprising if people, you know what I mean? It's, like, people would just be, they would snap, you know, when if they found that out.
Right.
So you're settling in here. You're fitting in. You're feeling all right and everything. And I think, as you note in the book, things turn sour here with this medical job because that's when Jim's wife. And talk a little bit about her because she, you know, you would think, well, I guess if he had this harem of lovers, God knows what's sort of like motivating her. But I guess we'll get into that. But the gist of where I'm going with this is, you know, things turn sour with you because they take you pretty much off the medical job. They cut you down to like one day a week for really sort of shady reasonings. And that's, I think, when you kind of are like, all right, what's going on here at this place, right?
Then I recognized color because it was brought to me. And I was working in the medical field, and Marceline comes up to me with someone that I went to school with, and she's a, you know, Caucasian girl, and blonde hair, and she says, you know, Pam Burns, so she can't work in the field, so you're going to go out back out in the field so many days a week. And I said, well, I burn because I'm, you know, light skin, you know, anybody can burn, okay?
Yeah.
So I go, I burn, and she looked at me like, are you getting, you know, are you being insubordinate? I was really upset because I thought, wait a minute, I'm supposed to be going to school to become a doctor. I'm studying to be a doctor. And I have to work back out in the fields because, so that's when I actually saw race.
Mm.
And it's crazy to think that I didn't really recognize it before, but that's when it all hit. I was so angry that I was shaking because the realization came to me that this is race. And Marceline was one of these people that walked around sweet, but she had a little temper too.
Yeah.
But she was just as, you know, just as responsible as Jim was because she put up with this for years. She knew exactly what was going on. So I don't give her any, she was an abused woman, obviously. In many ways, I'm sure, probably not physically, definitely emotionally and spiritually and, you know,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
Mentally
yeah.
Abused for sure. And fearful of him, you know, because of what she had to witness and know.
Mm.
And him humiliating her, having other women, and then bringing the child into the two children, apparently, supposed to be two children to the world that were out of wedlock, outside of that marriage. And so she had her own demons to battle with. But that's when I recognized that I looked at Jonestown and thought, this is like we're back in Mississippi picking cotton.
Exactly, yeah.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.